I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Food Network Obsessed. This is a podcast where we dish on all things Food Network with your favorite Food Network stars. I'm your host, Jamie Sire, and today we have someone with a seriously impressive resume and even more impressive work ethic. She reveals what it's like to brainstorm with her business partner slash husband and how it felt to win the hardest competition on Food Network. She is a chef, a serial entrepreneur, the youngest female chef to cook at the James Beard House, and the winner of Tournament of Champions Season 1, it's Brooke Williamson. Brooke, welcome to the podcast. I am so excited to chat with you today because I feel like at such a young age, you have already accomplished so much. Where does that go-getter attitude come from?
I do what I love to do. I think that that's where that comes from. It comes naturally because on a daily basis, I'm doing what I love. I don't know. Doesn't feel like I'm go-getting in a work mode. It feels like I'm just living my best life.
Well, I mean, you discovered what you loved at a very young age. At 15, you were a teacher's assistant at the Epicurean Institute of Los Angeles. So at what age did you realize that you wanted to become a chef?
Oh, probably like the age of 6 or 7. You know, I found myself watching Julia Child and Jacques Pepin on the TV on Saturday mornings instead of Saturday morning cartoons and for literally hours. And then I would take what I had just watched and go experiment in the kitchen from an insanely young age. And, you know, I think that just developed over time. By the time I was in like middle school and high school, I already knew that I wanted to be a chef long term.
Did your family cook a lot or were you kind of the one like taking charge in the kitchen?
Yeah, no, my mom cooked. She cooked dinner for the family 5 nights a week. You know, it was the kind of a situation where we sat down for dinner at 6:30 p.m. every single night of the week. My parents had their date night on Saturday. They would go out to dinner. I'd stay home with a sitter. And then Sunday night, we'd all go out to dinner as a family. So that was kind of our routine. And I would say that I grew up understanding the importance of sitting around a dinner table and sharing your lives at the end of the day and enjoying home-cooked food.
At the ripe age of 19, you became the youngest sous chef at the iconic Michael's in Santa Monica. What kind of attitude did you have in the kitchen back then?
I was a little girl. I was like a naive little girl who I kind of always did have that go-getter attitude. I feel like being successful at a young age, you had to have that attitude, like enter a situation that you weren't sure that you could really handle and test yourself. And, you know, it was kind of succeed or be eaten, you know, like literally I was a small female in a kitchen full of men at that age. And I had to have this air of confidence to me that I could sort of handle anything, regardless of whether or not I really believed that I could.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned it. How challenging was it to be a young female in a male dominated industry?
You know, I'd like to say that it had little to do with how I acted or reacted on a daily basis. But I think that that's a naive thing to say. And I actually feel like it was motivation to me to prove that I could handle myself in a professional manner and prove to my peers that I could do not only my job, but potentially their job better than they could. That was part of my motivation, was proving to people that like I was more than what I maybe looked like.
Yeah. I mean, you continued to do that. You became the youngest female chef to cook at the James Beard House. What characteristics about yourself do you think kind of propelled you into these opportunities as your career continued to grow?
You know, I think a lot of the opportunities that you're talking about kind of came to me, whether or not I was ready for them. I would enter scenarios where I wasn't really sure that I could handle it, but walked into a kitchen telling people I could handle it. And mm-hmm. then it was just a matter of sort of proving to myself whether or not I could handle it. And because I seemed to be able to carry my own weight in the kitchen, and I could cook and I could handle myself and I could work, you know, endless numbers of hours without complaining, I think that opportunities started presenting themselves to me before I was maybe ready for them. You know, I don't know that I was ready to be an executive chef at the age of 22. Pretty certain I wasn't. But, you know, I pulled it off. I faked it until I made it. And being offered the opportunity to cook at the James Beard House at that age, I knew the sort of grandiosity of the situation. But looking back on that, I really didn't, right? In the moment, I really thought I did. I was getting LA Times reviews at the age of 21. So I think that everything kind of snowballed into my life, right? The press that I got was partially probably because of my age and my gender. And I stuck out among a city full of older male chefs. And so people took note of me and what I was doing. And, you know, James Beard House caught wind of who I was and what I was doing and offered me an opportunity that obviously I wasn't going to turn down. And then I went and I did it and I did a good job. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And then 20 some odd years later, here I am.
Here we are.
It kind of just happened. Life just happened.
It does. Do you feel like cooking like comes very naturally to you, or was it something that you really had to, you know, work at to get to the level that you are?
You know, I, at the age of 18, walked into a kitchen, Ken Frank's kitchen at the Argyle Hotel on Sunset in Hollywood, and said to him, I'll do anything that you need done. You don't need to pay me. I just want to be in this kitchen. And he put me in the pastry department because that was the only thing he had available. I made it very clear that that's not where I wanted to land long term, but it got my foot in the door and I worked really hard. But I also decided not to go the route of culinary school per Ken Frank's advice. I was applying to the CIA at the time in Hyde Park, New York, and you had to have a number of actual restaurant hours to before you attended. And so I walked into the kitchen thinking I'll get my required hours and then I'll go to culinary school. And Ken said to me, you know, why not just work off of life experience and stay here? You have an entry level job in a good kitchen and we'll get you to where you want to be. So I took that advice. But because I didn't go to culinary school, I did definitely feel like I needed to spend the extra time educating myself in the fundamentals of cooking. Knife skills, how to make sauces, what the sauces were, how to debone a quail. I took my extra couple of hours a day and I read cookbooks and, you know, I spent that time educating myself. Fortunately, there was a sous chef at the Argyle Hotel who really took me under his wing and made a point of teaching me a new technique or method almost every day. So I had my own kind of personal culinary school, but I was very aware that I was in an industry and I was the gender that I was, and I was the size that I was, and I was the age that I was, and I needed to have the knowledge and the wherewithal to back it up.
And then at 24, you opened your first restaurant. If you could go back, what advice would you give yourself back then?
You know, everything that goes wrong when you're taking your first attempt at doing your own thing. Everything that goes wrong at that age feels devastating. And I think at the time, I couldn't see the bigger picture of all the things that I was getting out of failure. Now I look at the trajectory of my career and I look at what I've done, and I know in my head and in my heart that I wouldn't be where I am had I not gone through all of the messy failures and mistakes that I've made in my career. You know, at the age of 24, I might have done a little bit more investigating on the lease and the neighbors and the neighborhood and, you know, all the business savvy experience that I have now. I definitely would have done things differently. But, you know, I say that understanding that if I had done things differently, I wouldn't be where I am. So I take all of my failures in stride now, knowing that they are examples of how to do things differently.
What is the biggest lesson you learned from that first restaurant?
I mean, never take a location that doesn't already have a liquor license. I mean, get to know your neighbors and how they might fight everything you want to do. My husband and I opened that restaurant not understanding California laws and all of the hoops that you have to jump through in order to get a business to where you want it to be. And now if I were opening a restaurant that really needed alcohol involved, I would not go into a location that didn't already have that approved.
All right. Well, fast forward to present times, you and your husband and business partner, Nick, have opened multiple restaurants and food concepts over the years. How did the two of you meet?
I hired him when I was the chef at Zach's in Brentwood. I was 22. He was 22. Maybe he was still 22. I don't know. I hired him as my sous chef, and we actually worked with each other for a solid year before we even really got to know each other. We didn't look at each other romantically at first. We were definitely just colleagues, and eventually spent so much time with each other and realized that we had a lot in common. And that's kind of where that started. We actually didn't like each other very much for the first year that we worked with each other.
Really?
Yeah. Why? I mean, I think we were kind of competitive with each other. Mm-hmm. He kind of saw me as the young girl who was in a position that maybe she didn't deserve to be in, which is very valid. And he was like this cocky, annoying boy who came in and thought he could do everything better than I could. Which sometimes was true. Not everything.
You guys now are the owners of Playa Provisions, previous owners of Amuse Cafe, Hudson House, and the Triple. What does a brainstorming session with the two of you typically look like?
All of our restaurant concepts have happened very organically. We find a location, we look at the neighborhood, we think to ourselves, what can we bring to this neighborhood that doesn't exist already? When it comes to, you know, changing a menu or changing something within an existing restaurant, sometimes those conversations are a little bit more difficult. We don't always think the same way, which I think is part of the reason why we make great business partners. You know, I think we make up in each other what the other is lacking, either in that moment or in general. And we have very different trains of thought. Recently, I've kind of tended to take control over the menu a little bit more, and Nick is the guy that can kind of handle the staff issues and, you know, leave the creativity to me a little bit. So we make a great partnership.
What is your process for creating a cohesive menu?
Well, currently we only have Playa Provisions open, which is kind of a godsend right now when it comes to like staffing and only having to worry about one location. I'm very grateful right now that I only have to think about one location, but
it's four concepts, right?
It's four concepts. So it does feel like it's more than one location. It's several different menus. If you look at brunch and the cafe and the whiskey bar and the seafood restaurant, it's all the ice cream shop. I mean, there's kind of an outlet for every creative moment in my brain, but maybe 50 to 60% of the menu is like, it doesn't really change. They're staples that stay on the menu. And then the other percentage is seasonal. And you know, creatively, that keeps me on my toes. I'm kind of constantly changing the menu. I don't like to do giant menu changes where you're changing like 8 items in one day. I feel like it's really difficult for the kitchen staff to get a grasp on how to execute 8 new brand new dishes in one day. So I'm kind of, you know, weekly changing 1 or 2 items and rolling over seasons. By the time I get all of the fall menu items rolling, it's time to change the menu again. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's kind of a perpetual creative mode, which I appreciate. You know, it's not like my brain stops in between seasons. Sometimes I'll just get sick of a dish and I'll change it just because.
How do you test your ideas?
I don't know. I feel like I've been cooking for long enough to understand what's going to work and what's not going to work. That's not to say that's always the case. And sometimes I'll put a dish on the menu and I'm never quite satisfied with it. And it'll, you know, only last for a week or two. I have a garden at my house that I'm kind of constantly replanting stuff in. And so I'm very hyper aware of what's in season and what's in not just by literally walking out into my front yard. You know, I visit the farmer's market and I honestly can look. And I will say that I probably am most inspired by produce. So that's kind of what leads my head in certain directions. You know, I'll look at an artichoke and say, like, what do I feel like doing with artichokes? And kind of look around and see what else is looking good. And I don't know, it just happens very naturally for me. And, you know, sort of to my detriment, I try not to create the same menu item twice. Sometimes there are seasonal things that come back because people love them. But I will say that most of the time I'm kind of, it's not inspiring for me to put a menu item on the menu that was on the menu a year ago. You know, mm-hmm. I've grown, my customers have seen stuff already. I kind of always feel like I need to be reinventing who I am and how I think of food. Otherwise, it feels stagnant.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the garden. How long have you, you know, had the garden and been a gardener?
5 or 6 years. When we remodeled our house maybe 6 years ago. And I put a raised bed in the front yard. You know, sometimes it nags me and I don't necessarily feel like going out and like trimming the passion fruit vines every week. They grow like weeds. And sometimes it feels like just an extra chore. But I also feel like it really keeps me grounded in perpetual creativity and thought of what's going on seasonally. And keeps me on my toes. And I really enjoy watching things grow and seeing how I can make produce perform better. I've brought some cuttings back from Hawaii 4 years ago of a dragon fruit plant. Mm. And this year, for the first time, it fruited. And I had like beautiful, delicious dragon fruit.
Wow.
Yes, I said delicious. There's dragon fruit with flavor, which I never thought was possible. I have fruit growing. I'm like looking at my dragon fruit plant right now. And there's like 6 dragon fruit that need to be picked. The moment I saw the flowers flowering, it was like I had just given birth.
it's your dragon fruit baby.
My dragon fruit babies have arrived and I've been waiting 4 years for this. And it was really so gratifying. not that I even really want to eat them. I'm just excited. I feel very accomplished. There are certain things that make me feel very accomplished. And that was one of them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're lucky. You live in California, Southern California, where you can have a garden all year round. You know, growing up in LA, how did the California ingredients and just that influence kind of play a role in your perspective, you know, with your food and your cooking and your restaurants?
I mean, I think where you grow up has a great deal to do with how you develop as a person. And I think that's very true when you're a chef. You know, I think that every chef out there takes inspiration from their childhood. And for me, my childhood was like, I had a fruit and vegetable garden growing up. It was part of my daily life to go out and like pick stuff off of trees in my front or backyard. Going to the farmer's market was never something that like suddenly happened in my career. It was something that I grew up with. So I think that it plays a huge part in how I think of food. You know, I think that the fact that I'm inspired by produce is a testament to how I grew up and where I grew up.
Absolutely. You mentioned, you know, that you and your husband, when you first met, were kind of a little competitive. What's it like now? And what's the key to successfully working together with a partner?
it's really the only way we've ever known each other. So we were first successful colleagues, and then the romantic side came later. You know, I would be a liar if I said it's always been easy to work with my husband. We actually work very well together. But in that same breath, we take our work home with us. You know, we talk about work 24 hours a day. If things are crappy at work, then they're crappy at home. It's a double-edged sword. But at the same time, I don't have to explain to anyone what my day was like, because he inherently understands what the day was and why I'm in the mood that I'm in, or why I'm excited about something that happened. It's kind of, it eliminates the needing to like explain your day and not knowing if your spouse will understand it. You know, we both understand when the other one says like, I need to spend all night at work, or I need to go in early. And, you know, I'm personally very appreciative that I have someone who, you know, can get a phone call at 5 o'clock in the morning when somebody's forgotten their key to open up, who will jump in the car and run down to work for me. We're a great team. We pick up each other's pieces when we're not feeling it, and we can celebrate each other's successes because we understand them, unlike anyone else. But in the same breath, when we have a fight about in our personal lives, we bring it to work with us, you know, and everyone at work can feel it. We try not to let that happen very often. It was a little bit easier when we had multiple restaurants because we could kind of just spend the day at a different restaurant. I also will say that we probably see each other less now than we ever really have in our careers, because I travel a lot. In the last year, you know, I've probably been gone for a third of it. Mm-hmm. And as lovely as it is to have a business partner that I know can carry the weight at work, it's also wonderful to know that my husband is a father who is as involved and dedicated to being a parent as I am, because that's something that I really need in support of my career. So yeah, I mean, we do take long periods of time away from each other. And that's something that really didn't happen until I did TV.
Up next, Brooke talks about her experiences on both seasons of Tournament of Champions, and she reveals who she was most nervous to face off against.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I mean, obviously, Food Network fans got to see your competitive side on both seasons of Tournament of Champions.
What are you talking about? I'm not competitive
at all. Just not even a little bit. Season one, of course, you started off as the 7 seed, competed your way to victory when you bested Michael Vitaggio, Jet Tila, and finally Amanda Freitag for the win. You returned for season two. You made it all the way to the finale again, but defeated by Manit Chauhan.
Wah, wah.
I mean, it was such a great battle to watch. So, I mean, after winning season one, what made you want to return and do it all over again?
Nothing. you're assuming I wanted to return and defend
you
that title?
You kind of just had to, right?
There was a conversation that the guy had to camera during the finale of season one that was like, all four of you will be back next year. And I was like, really? I have this strange aching need to put myself in uncomfortable situations where I have no control. I think it's partially because I'm such a control freak in my life that I like, and I also am someone who likes to challenge themselves constantly. So being put in situations that are beyond my control, that's like, it's like a step in educating myself how to handle those scenarios. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something I'm really good at, as much as I am a control freak and as much as like I feel like competing takes years off of my life every time I do it. I also, there's like a thrill to it of knowing that you've put yourself in the most uncomfortable scenario and you come out on top. I strangely, I guess, have discovered that I'm good in these really high stress environments. And how do you even discover that, right? First of all, you have to put yourself in that position to even understand that and discover that. But then once you discover it, it's like, what's next? You know, like, what can I do with this? And the only thing really you can do with it is continue to do it.
Yeah. Well, so with that in mind, are we going to see you back for season three?
I suppose.
Twist your arm. Well, who are you most nervous to face off against in those two seasons?
Well, it's funny when you were talking about who I battled in season one, the one person you left out of that sort of list of people was Antonia LaFaso.
Oh, yes. How could I forget?
Antonia is one of my closest friends. She's also someone who I think because we're such good friends, I understand her completely. Like, we understand each other. We're actually very, very similar people. And I know how competitive she is and I know how talented she is. And, you know, I think that she has kind of been the one constant of a person that terrifies me in battle. And, you know, I happened to come out on top in season one battling her. And then I was fortunate enough to not have to battle her in season two, which she wasn't real happy about.
Is there a way to prepare at all? Or you just go in and see what happens?
Yeah, no, I think that going in to that scenario feeling inspired by food in general is the only way for me personally to prepare. You know, like, you can either handle those scenarios or you can't. And then it comes to like fine tuning your capability of winning those scenarios. And, you know, the randomizer is a whole thing. And I actually feel like it really evens the playing field, not knowing what you're walking into. And I think that having cooked professionally for 25 years is the thing that prepares me most for that, because I feel like I can walk into any scenario and kind of feel like I know what I'm doing. If you go into those battles and you aren't feeling inspired by food, like if you can't look at an ingredient and immediately think of something to do with it, then you're in trouble. Mm. And I think that the best way to do that is, you know, refresh yourself on some old menus, you know, look at pictures of food, kind of just be really hyper aware of how to treat ingredients. I'll spend a couple of days beforehand making sure that I'm just refreshed on what's in season and styles of cooking. And if I'm given Mediterranean food, what direction am I going to go? Because mm-hmm. I kind of know that it's a handful of things that I could be given.
Does a particular ingredient from the randomizer stand out as like being like especially challenging from either season?
Ingredient. I mean, there were some insane tools.
Okay. Well, like, yeah, tool either.
Like an able skeever. Like what? but ingredient wise, I feel like bitter melon was really difficult. Mm. I don't know. Like, I could look at any ingredient and say like that was difficult because of this, this, and this. But bitter melon is something that definitely stands out because it's not something that anybody really wants to taste.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a matter of like masking an ingredient, but also highlighting it.
On the floor in the competition, do you have like an oh no moment? And if so, like how do you push past that?
All the time. I mean, I feel like I live in the oh no moment. There were definitely moments where I thought to myself, I'm not going to finish. And I will say that in the finale of last season, when I looked at my broken hollandaise sauce and I knew that the ingredient that I had to put on the plate was in that hollandaise sauce and I had to use it. And I had literally seconds before I had to put it on the plate. There was no time to fix it. Like I know how to fix a hollandaise that's broken. I didn't have time to fix it. Mm-hmm. So I literally just had to put it on the plate and I looked at it and I was like, oh, this is the death of me.
You knew right then.
I knew right then. I knew the moment I put that sauce on the plate that the competition was over. It's a really heartbreaking feeling, you know, because you've gotten to this point where you hold yourself to such a high standard. And when you can't follow through, it's like you've failed. I plated that plate. I walked off the stage and I wanted to cry. And it's so funny because, you know, the competition's so lighthearted and you know, we're all friends and it's not life or death. And I knew like I had made it to the finale. It's as far as you can go. But I take what I do so seriously. And it's not even about being competitive. It's about performing at the top of my capabilities. And I want to be able to do that all the time. And when I can't and I don't follow through, it's really frustrating for me. But I think that that's what makes me a good competitor, is that I care so much.
That you care so much, and that's what keeps you coming back for more, right?
Oh, I know, right? What's wrong with me?
Do you think that that's the hardest? I mean, you've obviously done a lot of competition shows. Is that the hardest format that you've been faced with?
Yes. Fast-paced, timed, competitive cooking. There really is no more difficult scenario than being given ingredients and tools and a style or any parameters, and then having someone say you have 35 minutes, go. And it's really like, you know, once you're given those ingredients, it's really moments before you start cooking. So there's, you know, and I try to kill time. Like Guy will look over and be like, does anybody have any questions? I'll be like, yes, I have so many questions. And then I'll just be like talking. I'll be in my head thinking like, what can I do? What can I do? Just asking the most random questions that I really don't need an answer to, just to buy myself some
just
time.
Just stall a little bit. Do you have any pregame rituals?
I have a good luck charm that I carry with me, that I've carried with me since my son gave it to me when he was 4.5 years old for a competition. And that is always in my pocket when I compete.
What is it?
It's a little plastic lizard.
Oh.
Rubber lizard. So it fits very nicely in my pocket.
Well, I saw you got to be on the other side of the competition recently, filming Chopped for the first time, I saw on your Instagram. What was that experience like?
That was fun. You know, Chopped is a show that's been on for so long that mm-hmm. it felt very surreal. Like I walked onto the set and I was like, oh, this kitchen's so small. And it's, you know, like everybody's right here. I was very hyper aware of how nervous the competitors were because I've been there mm-hmm. so many times. So I think I approach judging maybe a little bit differently than people who haven't done a lot of competitive cooking do. But yeah, it was a very surreal experience just being on the set of Chopped, you know, sitting next to like Mark Murphy and Manit Chauhan and, you know, people who know the production so well that I just kind of wanted to make sure I carried myself well.
Mm-hmm. What would be your Chopped basket kryptonite?
I don't know. I've seen some crazy stuff. I think that the most difficult ingredients are the ingredients that are an entire like prepared meal, mm-hmm. you know, like a cake that's frosted and like has stuff on it, or like a sandwich, mm-hmm. you know, like
nachos. Having,
yeah. Like stuff that where you have to like pick stuff out of something to use, and deciding which component of that dish to use, I think I feel like would be overwhelming to me.
Yeah. I saw you're obviously recently a judge on Barbecue Brawl as well with Bobby Flay, Michael Simon, Eddie Jackson. I can only imagine what the behind the scenes of that set is like. Who acts up the most on that one?
That show was so much fun. And we spent 5 weeks in Austin, Texas. You know, I had so much fun getting to know everyone involved in that crew. And I can legitimately say that those guys are some of my closest friends now. And it's nice to be on a set where you develop friendships like that and they carry over into real life.
Yeah. What would be your personal like California spin on barbecue?
I don't know. I mean, I think that we're very vegetable forward here in California. I mean, of course, you know, you look at California barbecue, you think tri-tip and like Santa Rosa grills. I have a big green egg in my backyard. I smoke stuff all the time and not just in the summer. I actually, for Thanksgiving, I do turkey legs, giant turkey legs, like from, you know, medieval times.
Yes.
that's my favorite thing to barbecue. So I think that, you know, when I think barbecue, I don't necessarily think red meat, which I feel like most of the country does.
Well, you will soon be appearing on the new season of Best Thing I Ever Ate, which is such a great show because I just think it's so fun to hear chefs' personal favorite food experiences at other restaurants. What makes a memorable meal to you?
A memorable meal, it's experiential, right? I think that there's something to be said for a delicious, you know, great tasting, well-prepared meal. At the same time, there's something to be said for sharing that meal with great people, being in an environment where you want to stay and hang out and create memories. To me, there's a lot involved in a great meal. It kind of goes beyond even just what the food is.
Do you have a favorite food city?
I've been so fortunate in the last 8-10 years to be able to do a lot of traveling within the United States. I've really discovered so many little pockets of incredible food in places that I didn't anticipate it. I do an event for the Kentucky Derby called Taste of the Derby, and it takes me to Louisville once a year. Mm-hmm. And I've discovered some really incredible food in Louisville. I will say that Austin had some really great food. I went to a restaurant in Houston recently called Crawfish and Noodles with Chris Shepherd, took me and Gail Simmons there. It was one of the most incredible food experiences I've had in a very long time. Like, just brought us tons of like Cajun Vietnamese food.
Wow.
It was incredible. I love a city where it feels appropriate to combine different cultures that you don't anticipate because of the demographics of that city and how they mesh and meld with each other. You know, it feels very organic, but at the same time, like Cajun Vietnamese, what? You know, but
yeah,
it totally works.
I love hearing that. I wish we could keep talking for hours, but we are running short on time. So I'm going to finish this off with a little rapid fire round. And then And then we have one final question for you. All right. So favorite tattoo?
I will say it's my son's handprints from when he was 6 months old.
Oh, I love that. Favorite part of living in California?
I can run outside any time of the year.
Hidden talent?
I am really good at memorizing lyrics to songs, including like mid-90s rap songs.
Especially mid-90s
rap songs. So you can put on a pretty almost any mid-90s rap song and I will know at least 3/4 of the words.
That is an amazing talent. What what about a talent that you wish you had?
I wish I could play an instrument.
Any particular one? Just any?
Piano. I feel like piano is something that could be like cathartic for me. But it's really not because I can't play it.
It'll just be more stressful. Go-to snack?
Popcorn.
Favorite dish to cook with your family?
Not really a dish, but something that I cook often with my son is boba.
Oh.
He's obsessed with boba. And we make like fresh boba and a milkshake probably once or twice a week.
Wow. Latest food obsession.
I have this clementine tangerine tree in my front yard that has in the last couple of years matured to the point where it's literally the most delicious tangerine that you could ever imagine. It's like really low acid, super sweet, no seeds. And every time I walk out of my house, I grab one off the tree and I eat it.
That sounds like the perfect snack. Most used kitchen tool?
Microplane, maybe.
Okay. All right. Well, that concludes the rapid fire round. We have one final question, though, that we do ask everybody here on the podcast, and that is, what would be on the menu for your perfect food day? So we want to hear what you're having for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and dessert. There are no rules, so you can travel, you can time travel, spend as much money as you want. It is your day.
I would start my morning with a cappuccino and some delicious pastries. I do love just a good plain butter croissant and a glazed donut, like a simple, like Krispy Kreme glazed donut.
Okay.
Lunch, a corned beef Reuben with like Thousand Island and coleslaw and melty Swiss cheese on marble rye bread. Can I have a happy hour with like a glass of champagne
100%
or a margarita maybe, and for a perfect martini, and
or all three, whatever,
and classic caviar service.
Okay, I'm inviting myself to happy hour.
And then I'd like a bowl of ramen. Ramen is kind of my go-to craveable food. That and sushi is kind of a toss-up. And then for dessert, I want just like a really simple flan, like a perfectly cooked flan.
Okay.
Light, like not too dense. During the pandemic, I got really into perfecting my flan game.
Okay.
So I feel like I would like my own flan.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you cooking the flan for
Yeah,
for
I'll cook the flan. And okay. I'll eat the whole thing. Yeah. And maybe like, maybe also like a slice of like old fashioned, lots of layers, rich chocolate cake.
Okay. Just like a little one or a big one.
I mean, whatever.
Like I said, calories don't count on this.
It's my dream day.
On this question. So thank you so much for taking the time. Loved hearing about your journey and what we see on TV right now and how it all got started. So thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Talk about the embodiment of a girl boss. Brooke has got it all. You can catch Brooke on the new season of Best Thing I Ever Ate, premiering on Sunday, November 21st at 10, 9 Central on Food Network. Thanks so much for listening, and make sure you follow us wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a thing. And of course, if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review. We love it when you do that. That's all for now. We'll catch you foodies next Friday.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.